what does it mean to have escaped oppression and then to come to America and be part of yourself, part of an oppressive system, and be part of the oppressor, which I think is really a very American story. Harm is ongoing. It's both the legacy of the harms that were directly created by policy and law of the 18th and 19th centuries and 20th centuries. And there's just also a continued disregard. Our job here is to be a good ancestor. How do we, living today, fix any problems that we ourselves have created or that we have benefited from, so we're not passing on a mess for our children and grandchildren to take care of? If you're living in America today, you are benefiting from the taking and theft of native land. So this isn't something that happened in the past that we're just walking away from. This continues to this day.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Tilting at Windmills. I'm Mike Donahue, and I'm very fortunate today to be joined by Rebecca Claren, who is the award-winning journalist and author of her latest book, The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Mike.
So I loved the book, and it's available Amazon, wherever fine books are sold. The core theme of the book, I think, is based on your own family history, this constant intertwining of the treatment of the Native Americans by the U.S. government, and in a way, the treatment of Jews through time, and just the fact that your grandparents, your great-grandparents, et cetera, were Jews who were persecuted in Eastern Europe, came to America, and then lived side by side with this other group of people who were themselves being persecuted. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. I was very curious to try and answer, what does it mean to have escaped oppression and then to come to America and be part of yourself, part of an oppressive system, and be part of the oppressor, which I think is really a very American story, because it's, my family is Jewish, and this story is told in the specifics of being Jewish, but so many non-Indigenous people came to this country having left very horrible circumstances and came to America for so many of the reasons that so many immigrants today come to America. They're hoping for a better life and a better future for their children. But what does it mean to come here and then benefit on the heels, on the backs of others?
Yeah, in terms of emotions through the book, and obviously your family had a lot of ups and downs, but that progression into quote-unquote Americanism made me feel really proud to be an American. But then all the accounts of how Americans treated the Indians made me embarrassed to be an American. So it was a bit of a tug of war going on there.
I'm so glad. Actually, to me, the book, it aims to get away from a binary that people or nations are good or bad, and to messy that idea, to make it complicated, because I think that's where the truth lies. So I'm glad to hear that it brought up that real range of emotions for you.
Yeah. And so it's something, and in general, I think Americans have a conflict past about Native Americans. And I think especially maybe in the last decade or so, I think they may have been caught up in this sort of anti-woke, anti-progressive sort of narrative that exists out there. And I was struck also by the fact that the people that you were talking to and gathering information from were still to this day relaying incidents where they had been physically, verbally abused.
Absolutely. It was not uncommon in any way. As I was visiting reservations in the Dakotas, for Native people who live there to describe the Dakotas as the Mississippi of the North, that the way the racism there is, it's individual and it's systemic.
For sure. And so to me, through the reading of the book, because you start fairly far back in history, I want to say around the 1850s. Yeah, I kept wondering or kept waiting when is the U.S. government going to start treating them nice? So as you can tell, it was a bit of a wait. And to be honest, even in the summation with President Obama's quietest apology, as it's called, it doesn't feel like we've even gotten there. Like, even to this day, there's still this necessary remediation that's hanging out there.
Absolutely. For people who haven't read the book, an indigenous elder directed me. She said, if you're going to try and look at these entangled histories of immigrants and Native people, specifically through the lens of your family, you need to think about how you're going to respond. And you should look to your own culture for guidance about that. So that led me to study Jewish texts, ancient Jewish texts, and also contemporary rabbis that are like writing and talking about those texts for guidance on how do you grapple with what's happened. And Maimonides, who was a 16th century Jewish philosopher, he lays out this very kind of irritatingly legalistic, scripted rules for how to repent, but it's also so beautiful and it still has so much resonance today. And the first one, there's these five or six steps, and the first one is stop doing the harm. And I would argue, and I think this book shows, we haven't stopped in America doing harm to Native Americans. The harm is ongoing. Mm-hmm. It's both the legacy of the harms that were directly created by policy and law of the 18th and 19th centuries and 20th centuries. And there's just also a continued disregard. People in Indian country talk about, we have the wrong superpower here because we're invisible.
This wouldn't be a good podcast unless I was wrong about something. So let me throw out some commonly held, decent percentage of Americans, because when they hear about remediation or the other R word, reparations, everybody gets a twitchy, right? And how do you explain to those people? And again, you mentioned referring to your own culture. What are the norms in terms of making things right? And I was wondering, A, if you had come across any cultures that believed in remediation in a multi-generational fashion, right? So where generational trauma is passed down, there's the other generations on the other side feel obligated to remediate. And more just in general, I think there's this perception that, okay, we won, they lost, so you got to deal with it, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for asking that. I think that is a really important thing to talk about. When historians today, Margaret Jacobs in particular, she wrote a really wonderful book called After 100 Winters that came out with Princeton. She's a professor of the Great Plains out of the University of Nebraska. And she lays it out. She says, if you're living in America today, you are benefiting from the taking and theft of Native land. So this isn't something that happened in the past that we're just walking away from. This continues to this day that if you, and I thought a lot about like, how do we measure our distance from a harm? And that direction to measure our distance is something that I learned about through reading the Torah. My distance to the harm of caused to Native Americans from the taking of their land, the forced attempts to forcibly assimilate Native people so that their cultures would be less reliant on land. Because my family had a homestead, federal homestead, which meant they got free land on the South Dakota prairie that was theirs to keep if they could turn wild land, wild grasslands into farmland. That land had been Lakota land. My distance to that history and that harm is closer than someone whose family arrived on slave ships or came to America last week. But if you're living here, no matter who you are, you're benefiting because the taking of Native lands is the underpinning of our highway system. The breaking of treaties is the basis for so many of our cities in America. The flooding by federal dam projects of Native lands, those dams, for so many of us living in America, are how we get the power that we use in our homes. The list goes on, and I lay out a lot of specifics in my book. And so there's that first to say, because I think it's very easy to say, I haven't done anything wrong. Me personally, I did nothing wrong. That same sort of, it's on the spectrum of that same argument. There was a war. They lost, we won, get over it, that kind of thing. And yet, if you can try and find yourself in this story and start to see the way you yourself living today have actually benefited, are actually benefiting, I think it makes it a lot more personal. That's a lot of what I did in this book. And I actually have resources in the back of the book that I hope will be helpful to readers who are curious to find themselves in the story, to help to do their own research. I have been very influenced by a Yurok Indigenous judge and elder named Judge Abby Abenanti. She's the Chief Justice of the Yurok Nation. The Yurok are in Northern California. She was also a Superior Court judge for the state of California for many decades. And I've come to know her through the course of my work. And she and I did an event in San Francisco together a few months ago. And when someone asked this question in a different way, but in the audience, she said something I keep thinking about, which is she said, our job here is to be a good ancestor. How do we, living today, fix any problems that we ourselves have created or that we have benefited from, so we're not passing on a mess for our children and grandchildren to take care of? To me, that is a reason, if none other, but yet it gives me the sense of responsibility instead of like trying to figure out how maybe people I don't even know have been impacted. And she also talks about how to do that is to form relationships with the people that have been harmed and to follow their lead on what would help them. She talks about how reparation is a bank word, and maybe finances would be part of this. But what I've heard over and over again from Native elders that I've talked to is far more than them saying, we want money, is we want an apology. We want this history told in all of its complexity. The fact that we in America and in our schools so often don't teach the depth and breadth of what America very intentionally did to harm Native people, that is so much of a cost. And I think it's a really important place to start. So I agree. People hear reparations, they get very nervous. How am I going to have to pay for this? But reparations can look a wide variety of ways. And unlike countries like Australia or New Zealand or Canada that all have very complicated histories of colonialism, of taking the land from the indigenous people that live there, of really mistreating and harming the cultures and the individuals of those indigenous populations, those countries have actually started imperfectly, but have at least started to grapple with their histories in a very public way. America is really, we're very far behind. So I think reparations is really far way down from where we need to start, which is first, stop doing the harm. And secondly, start to tell this story in a more truthful way.
Great point. But they do also want something else besides the apology. They want their land back.
Sure. Yes, they do. And yet what I've been told, and of course, I didn't talk to every, there are almost 600 federally recognized Native nations in our country. There are so many individual people. Of course, I haven't talked to all of them. I don't mean to speak for everyone. And I'm not really the right person, to be honest, to be the person talking about what Native people want and need. I'm a white lady who lives in Oregon. You know what I mean? But what I've been told is we know what it's like to be kicked off our own land. We don't want to do that to other people. We know how cruel that is. But if we can get our lands back, we're going to. So there are a lot of efforts throughout the country of people, of non-natives helping Native people to buy back their land or to give back land that was theirs traditionally.
But you can understand why that's a tough sell to the average American guy, because they're sitting there thinking, my family doesn't have any personal experience. I don't know any Native Americans. Things aren't great just in general for me. And I think we have in general a lessening or a decline in the amount of empathy we tend to have for other people. Societal norms seem to be indicating that we're losing our empathetic touch. it's a hard sell, yeah?
Of course it is if you don't know the history. In my experience, learning the history in all its complexity and nuance, context, it actually has expanded my empathy. And when I say the history, I'm not just talking about Native history. When I wrote this book, I had so many layers of editorial feedback from Lakota people and Jewish people to make sure I wasn't doing this, to make sure I was writing this with as much cultural sensitivity as I could. And it was really interesting. I hired a couple Lakota sources I really trusted to read the book before my editor at Penguin even ever saw it. And they, for the most part, were like, yeah, you did a great job. And the Jewish people I had, who the Jewish historians who read it, the Jewish scholars said, I think you might have some internalized anti-Semitism to deal with. And it was really interesting. And what I did then was to more deeply study the history of the Jews. And it was so interesting to me to see in myself that my empathy for my family, for my people, expanded by understanding the roots of so many ways that we are today. And yeah, I understand that we don't have as much empathy for Native people. To me, I link that directly to the fact that we don't teach the history of America's policies and laws that impacted Native people and are impacting Native people. We don't teach that, so we don't have that empathy. We don't have that personal connection. We don't have that sense of inherited responsibility because we don't know that we have one. And I can see why would someone want to then step towards learning this if you're going to think, oh, that's just going to make me want to do something about it. But I think that's a question for how do you want to live? And to me, it goes back to that other point I made. What do you want to pass on to your children? What kind of a world do you want them to live in? It's a personal question. And I'm going to maybe answer it differently than someone else. I don't think my book's for everyone. I don't think that everyone is going to suddenly wake up and say, oh, I can't wait to read and learn about how there's a myth about America. But I want to believe there are a lot of people who want a more perfect truth.
But you can understand the pushback, because I think on some levels, maybe white Americans who maybe don't have a cultural touchstone to refer back to. And so in your situation, they thought maybe you had some latent anti-Semitism, right? And that goes back to just the cultural sensitivity. I don't know that a large segment of our population feels good about making that cultural sensitivity effort, or they view it as too much of an effort, or they view it as silly or stupid.
I suppose that's their business. What Judge Abbey has said and does say is, we in America have our culture is capitalism, right? And so we have to look for other cultural models that resonate with us. But people that have spent lots of time in jail, she talks about like jail is its own culture. And there are elders within a jail system even that you can talk to about the roots of how your culture works. And they're not that far removed from the cultures that their family had before they came to America. And they can go and learn about those, and maybe they will resonate with them. The point is to find a model of ethics, which is baked into most cultures, for how to respond when a harm has been done, even one you didn't directly commit, but one you've benefited from. Because in my experience, having a cultural model that you believe in, it helps you. It's not like I read the Torah or the Talmud and think every single thing in there is something I should learn from. That's not a way to live. But if there is something that inspires me, that is a metaphor I can embrace, learning that I can embrace, why wouldn't I?
You mentioned the myth of America, the shining city on the hill and so forth, which I believe, maybe not in American exceptionalism per se, but I'm very proud to be an American and I'm proud of what this country represents in a lot of areas. When you were writing the book, did you also come across the sense that there's also this mythos of the Native American Indian prior to the U.S. rubbing borders with them, in terms of they were peaceful, they didn't understand private property, they were one with the earth, just this almost celestial kind of super ethical, highly desirable sort of state to be in? I don't know that I'm communicating that.
I don't know what you're asking me. I have to say, are you saying Was there a myth about Native people that I thought that I was interrogating?
I think in the consciousness of America, there is that stereotypical Indian who's wise, peaceful, at one with the earth.
Sure. So what's the question about that?
The question is, did you encounter that? Did you break any of those stereotypes yourself? Is that a fair description? Did you...
Again, I'm a little uncomfortable being like a voice for Native people since I'm not Native. Okay. So please hear all this with a great amount of, I don't know, just awareness for that. What I was taught by Lakota people is that there is a real traditional cultural way to be in reciprocity with the earth, with nature. One of the edits that I got from a Lakota friend at Source was, I had talked about someone living traditionally on the land, and he said, we didn't own land, we lived with the land. We did not think of ourselves as more important than the land. And so much of the legends and origin stories I've read of Lakota people hold that up. Were they peaceful? No. There were wars. There were many wars. And there was violence traditionally with other Native nations. And I can't remember what the other like myth or idea Native people have of being wise. I don't know. I encountered many people who were wise and many people who weren't that wise. The Native people I've met are often, they're just humans. No, they're not. They're perfect and imperfect like anyone else. And I hope that comes across in the book, in the Native people that I am talking about. But that wasn't really the point of my book to do that.
Part of the pushback is, I think sometimes when Americans start talking about slavery and the treatment of Native Americans, there's this instinctive reaction to say, what about them? Or what about this? Or what about that? And so my forefathers, I have an Irish heritage, and I can't imagine there. You recount a conversation that you were having at the dinner table where just after 9/11, a member of AIM, American Indian Movement, said to you, now you know what it feels like to be attacked. And when I read that, my initial thought was, she knows as much about being attacked as I do about the British starving me. Does that make sense?
Say more. I don't know. Yeah.
So she made it seem like, now you know how it feels to be attacked, inferring that she bears that generational trauma of being attacked.
Yeah.
But for me, and so let's talk about when the British starved and killed millions of Irish people with the Great Potato Famines, the reason that my family...
Was that your grandparents or your parents?
Great. Okay. Way back.
So that is a different relationship. Wounded Knee, the woman who was speaking with me, that was probably her grandparents. And that is a much closer kind of relationship. She would have... I don't know the specifics because she has died and I haven't spoken with her about this. But from what I've been told about like oral history and oral tradition in Lakota culture... Traditionally, Lakota wasn't a written language, and kids would learn from their grandparents the stories of their people, and they would be taught and told them. And so it could have even been her father or mother who escaped and survived Wounded Knee, or other family members. That's a very close relationship. She's absolutely growing up with that trauma that those people experienced and that they're handing down. I would argue that unless you grew up learning about the potato famine in a really real, really like direct way, that is a different kind of relationship with history. Again, I'm going to talk about Judge Abby, and I mentioned this in the book. She said there was a longing for me in the book to, as I'm learning and investigating and interrogating my own family histories, my own family stories. There were no stories about my family and their Lakota neighbors. And I wonder why. They lived very close to one another. There were photographs of my family posing with Lakota people and Dakota people. But yet, we didn't have stories about them. I didn't know what they thought. Did they understand that they had escaped oppression only to now live so close with people who were being so terribly oppressed? And Judge Abby stopped me at one point when I was grappling and wrestling with this out loud. And she said, everyone knew what was happening to Indians. And then she said, but when you're running for your life in trauma, which is when you're running for your life in terror, which is what your family was doing when they came to this country, you're not stopping to have a quick restorative justice conversation along the way. She said it takes several generations to not grow up with what we now call inherited trauma before you can start to step towards this history and think about repair. She said that's why it's appropriate that it's come to you and your generation, because it was my great-grandparents and great-grandparents who were on the prairie. My grandmother lived in South Dakota as a baby, but I'm that far removed from that. I didn't have to live and grow up in a traumatic family environment. And so I have that capacity to start to consider it in a way that my ancestors really didn't. So I think that's what I would say to you about the potato famine. Like, that was horrible what happened to your ancestors. And I'm so sorry that it happened to them. And I recognize that not enough has been done. I don't know this history, but I'd be curious, like, what, if anything, did the British do to consider those harms that they created for the Irish, like your family?
I think it's starting to come full circle finally for me now, is that the core difference between that situation and this situation is that Ireland has gotten its independence and is now effectively a peer to the United Kingdom. Whereas, as you said, the hurt is to this day continuing. The Ireland-British relationship is not an open sore. There's not active harm being done at this time. But that's the difference with the Lakota situation, is that active harm is still being done to this day.
I love how you put that. Exactly. The United States signed treaties with the Lakota Nation and scores of others. And those treaties are technically the highest law of our land. And they are not being upheld. There is, if there was a different makeup on the Supreme Court, those nations could bring a law, bring us a case to say, why is the United States not upholding these treaties? And I wonder if someday that'll happen.
I know your rabbi that you mentioned said the opposite, but I'm just wondering, is it unfair to judge the people there, the time and the decisions they made and the context and culture that they lived in, by anything even approximating today's standards?
Yes and no, in my opinion. I think it's very important to consider our ancestors and what they did deeply in the context and understanding of their times, of what they were coming from, what they were running from, what they were carrying emotionally. It is not really, on the one hand, quote unquote, fair to look at them through today's lens. And yet, I am living in today's lens. Any book written is always more a book that speaks to this contemporary moment than it does to the past. And so even though I think having compassion for them, that doesn't excuse them for any harms that they created. It doesn't relieve me personally of a responsibility to consider how I might do something differently today.
Yeah, a good example might be the Native American boarding schools that people set up. Obviously, a huge source of controversy right now in Canada just because of the maltreatment. But in my readings, they thought, the white people at the time thought they were doing the right thing by educating them.
There's a lot of white people, right? I think there was a mix of feelings. So the way the United States sold the idea of the boarding schools to the American public initially was to say, yes, what we now consider incredibly racist, misguided ideas about how this concept that a culture like a person would evolve. Remember that this idea, the roots of Nazism is found in this same concept, this like cultural evolution concept, because Aryans are at the top and the best in this very detailed kind of anthropological idea of what makes a culture savage or barbarians or civilized was the top. And this idea being the United States, and was how the United States government was selling it to the American public in the newspapers and in speeches, was we, through conversion to Christianity, through education, through the teaching of farming, if we give them these gifts, they will evolve much more quickly than traditionally what historically would have happened. They will much more quickly become civilized. very quickly, the United States is seeing in real time how this doesn't work. That's a failure. That in fact, Native people are really struggling far more in all these different benchmarks after they're being quote unquote made to be civil. But the United States just keeps changing their reasoning for why they need to forcibly assimilate a Native people or why they need to take the land. At one point in the book, I say, I know I sound like a broken record, but frankly, the record is broken because it starts to become so clear. This is so much of, there are true believers clearly, and there are other people that just really want to take Native land, and they're going to come up with whatever window dressing they can find to justify the taking of Native land.
Maybe spreading democracy.
You said it.
One thing that I found really neat, again, I think I mentioned it early on, was that how your family managed to walk that line between retaining cultural integrity and cultural norms, yet still becoming American with a capital A and continuing that down. Immigration is obviously a huge issue right now. And I think part of the reason that Europe and America struggle with it is because there's a feeling that what we see is that ideal type of assimilation that many of the Europeans had when they came here. That's not happening today. Do you have any?
There's some really racist ideas in the idea of the melting pot because, yeah, there's this American myth that we're all going to assimilate and become American. The pressure is to be white. The pressure is to be Aryan. The pressure is to assimilate into whiteness and lose any culture that doesn't embrace capitalism and beauty standards and family systems that look like Nordic, Aryan, Eastern Europeans. And so I think that's a first thing to really carefully examine when we talk about assimilation. What are we really saying when we say we're a melting pot society? Really, are we? Because my family comes to America, and yes, it's true. They want to be capital A Americans, as you put it. They're racing to drop their accents. They're racing to speak English perfectly, to look American, whatever that means. So many women are dyeing their hair blonde, are not eating enough to look Aryan, right? But when I started to really investigate and dig into that, what I started to see is that's so much about fear. For my family and for, I think, so many, they're coming from a history of Jews who for centuries have been exiled from whatever nation they're a part of. And so they're wanting to look like they belong. And that is about survival. And that is about maintaining a better place for their children. I don't blame them for that at all. It makes sense to me. But I don't anymore sort of prize what it means to be quote unquote American in that way of being like everyone else as much as maybe I used to, when I now understand that fear that was driving that. My great grandmother told her sons when they're living on the prairie and they're homesteading, she says, you have to become not only rich in America, you have to become multimillionaires. And so much of that wealth will come from land. When I really understood more of where my great-grandmother is coming from, having lived most of her life in Russia, in a shtetl where Jews were mostly not allowed to own land or to live anywhere else, that is about security. That because the history of Jews in exile is that wealthy Jews were often allowed to stay longer in the countries of their origin, more than the non-wealthy Jews. And so she's telling her children, this is how you will make it in America. This is how you will be safe.
So you've been studying the Native American and the land thing for some, I think you said some 20 years now?
Oh, I've been a journalist writing primarily about the American West for about 23 years. Throughout that time, have written about Native nations and Native Americans individually. But it isn't the only thing I've written about. But yeah, for the last maybe 7 years, it's been more of a focus.
So I guess my question would be, is there hope for optimism? Do you feel like you've seen any sort of degree of change since when you first were exposed?
Just the fact that a major U.S. publisher published this book, thought that it was a book that people would read, and the fact that thousands of people have been reading it since the book came out in October says to me there is reason for optimism. Yes, and certainly there are so many efforts that are successful being led by Native Americans to become more visible in the media, in storytelling, in television shows and movies. The fact that Killers of the Flower Moon is a huge hit in Hollywood as we speak, I think that all gives me hope of increased visibility. And I do feel optimistic that if our children learn this history, they may create a society that is different.
So let's say you do come across someone who's sympathetic, empathetic. They have no idea what they can do, right? Other than changing their attitude and mindset. Do you have tangible suggestions of how people can just personally attempt to create some form of personal remediation?
Absolutely. I do, in my book, direct people to many different ideas and efforts that they can participate in. I think the most important thing as a non-Indigenous person is to not just decide what you think would be the right thing to do to repair. There are so many incredible national and local Native-led organizations that are considering how to repair these harms, how to help nations get their land back through private land sales. When private land comes up for sale, they are raising money to slowly buy land that those were traditional Native lands back for those Native nations. And there are in many U.S. cities, there's something called the land tax that's voluntary, where individuals can acknowledge, oh yeah, the treaty that was signed with a Native nation that was broken is why I can live in this city, why I can own property here. And so you can voluntarily make a gift to the Native nation whose land you are living on, or based on that treaty that's still their land. And there's so many other examples. But yeah, I would say finding yourself in the story, supporting the Native nations that are somehow related to and meaningful to you, maybe because of where you live or where you used to live. I think those are important first steps, or maybe just steps. I don't know if they're the first ones, but they're important.
Any progress is good. So we've been talking a lot about land and the conflict. I think I would be remiss, given what's going on in the world today, if I didn't try and draw some allegory between this and the Israeli-Palestine situation. And if you're not comfortable talking about it, we don't have to, but I'd be curious as to what your thoughts are and if you see any of the equivalencies.
Yeah. Thank you for the way you asked that. My book came out October 3rd, and that Hamas committed their massacres October 7th. This book was not written to be a comparative history of the United States and Israel, but certainly there are so many rhymes and resonances. The histories are not exactly the same. The fact that for some Jews, many Jews, they consider Jews native to Israel is a sort of substantial difference in the way they orient themselves. There's not a single non-native person living in America today who could argue that they are native to this land. But certainly there are just so many rhymes and resonances. It makes me so upset to think about the way that the Israeli government describe people living in Gaza and the West Bank as savages. That is then used to justify the murder of each other's children. It's so upsetting to me. And that is the same kind of language that the United States used to describe Native people, because if someone is less than human, it makes it easier to kill them. And it's not something that's new. For a long time, Palestinians and Native Americans have found a kinship in each other. One of the things that is really chilling to me is post-Holocaust in Germany, the government has made it a law that children there mandatorily learn the history of the way Germany treated Jews. And students who don't want to learn this history. There was a Frontline report about this in the last decade. And people who were critical of this law, they said, why should we have to learn our history? But the way Germany treated the Jews is really no different than the way America treated the Indians or the way Israelis are treating Palestinians.
The analogies are out there.
Yeah.
I want to try and end this on a positive note. I will say, just to hop back a bit, when we were talking about finding something local, there's a website I use called native-land.ca.
Yes. That's a great, yeah, it's so great. You put that in and you can get put in a zip code and it'll tell you the Native nations that lived and hunted on that land and maybe still are there. That is a wonderful place and a, like a really sweet first step to find yourself in this history. That's great.
Yeah. So what we like to do at the end of these, and I really super appreciate the time and I think it's been great and the book is great, is we ask our guests to recommend some piece of media.
Love it.
I'm dating
myself. Oh, I love it.
So for the people out there that are looking to consume something new, maybe they haven't been exposed to, what's getting you going at the moment?
I could go on and on. It's going to be, I'm a very bossy reader. I love to tell people what to read. Reservation Dogs, if anyone hasn't seen it yet, is an award-winning, critically beloved show. You can find it on Hulu or FX. And it's just, to me, one of the best written and acted shows on television ever. It's in a very acute way, the story of four kids in Oklahoma who are indigenous and their lives. But it is very empathetic. It's so sad, but it's so funny. It's just excellent. So I would start there first. Stop doing all your jobs and just watch that show. I am currently reading a book called Council of the Dolls that is out this year, or maybe it came out in 2023. That's really, it's a novel. So much of the history I write about in my book, The Lakota History, it's an indigenous author, and Powers is the last name. It's a novel version of the history I'm describing. So I would recommend that book as well.
Great.
Have you read this, The Diaries of Sacagawea? How do I say it? Sacagawea?
Oh, is it Sacagawea?
It's called The Lost Journals of Sacagawea, a novel. It's so fascinating. And the premise is that this is the journal that this teen girl who we know about as being part of the Lewis and Clark expedition, what her story really is. And it's imagined, but it's so powerful. I learned that name is Sacagawea, but I know that's not how it should be pronounced. I believe it's Sacagawea. Sacagawea. But again, I probably say that.
It's all right. You get a pass. Rebecca Claren, author of The Cost of Freeland, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance. Thank you so much for taking the time today to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Great conversation.